Hold on. Yes, the discussion, I think it matters the fact that we have please fill the chairs of DM group here in this room. And by the way, this is bringing us back to the very near term future. Sorry, I forgot to take the question and I'm going to. And so yesterday, for those of you who don't remember, we mentioned that right now it takes roughly half an hour to human vetting before we can send an alert out. And some of the reason why it may be problematic to automatize the process has been made previously by you and others. So I have this proposal, and you throw it there so that people can think, and then a kind of expansion of what I said yesterday. So what I thought we could do, I'll propose it, which would not add anything, would not change anything or remove anything, would just add capabilities. So the astronomers which still want to do what we're doing on one can still do that way. And that would be basically to allow pipelines who can show that their false alarm is reliable. And by reliable, I mean that if a pipeline finds something with a false alarm or not, 10 to 6, for example, that should really only happen once every 11 days, because that's what this false alarm means. So if pipelines can satisfy this criteria, and I believe we do have pipelines that are reliable in that term, then they could be allowed to send automatic alerts every time they have a trigger with whatever false alarm and threshold we have. So the way I thought we could implement this in practice so that astronomers would still be able to neglect this is just adding whatever format we send out, GCN or anything else, tag or label or whatever automatic, so that the end partner at this point can decide to discard everything which has automatic label and just wait for the humanly vetted alert or just follow this up if they want. And then we could still continue to do what we did in one, which is the human vetting. And half an hour later, we can either confirm that the event was to be taken seriously or retract it. And two critical things I think should go together with is that people at the site, in San Angel, in the Virgo, which went online, should be able to have a way to pose the automatic alerts for all pipelines because they saw there's something clearly wrong in the detector. They are the person obviously which are most qualified to know that. And this could be done either through some ad hoc software or putting one in the state vector. And for the same reason, developer of any particular pipeline should be allowed to stop the alert being automatic for their pipeline if they notice a problem. And again, as I said, this basically will just add something, not remove. So if you are Fermi or Swift or whatever, and you like to continue to just follow events which have been approved by humans, you can. You just ignore everything that contains the automatic tag. If you feel instead that getting something in a minute rather than half an hour, can significantly compensate for the risk of getting occasional junk, then you can just follow those up. And that's everything I offer. It's just for people to think about it and think.
Would you pick a different bar or a different threshold?
That is a possibility. We could ask the false alarm for automatic events to be slightly different. It's not a requirement, strictly speaking, but it's a possibility. And by the way, I don't want to hijack. I know we have something else to do. So we can either take this on the menu or this and later. I don't want to surface it. Discuss this now because it's relevant in a moment or a month and a half.
So this is a great idea. Why haven't we been here? Because the idea is brand new. So this is the first one.
You have a great idea. One of the
two had it on our mind. Well, that's part of it.
Yeah, I don't think it's not very new.
I think it's something great. But we have to know a bit more about the performance of the machines, before we can say
we're good at Fermi and Fermi.
Yeah. In the measure that we find that we're delivering something of quality and we understand what we are doing, I think it's something we can say.
I mean, I'll tell again, the reason why I started thinking about this yesterday, I complained yesterday, is because I know there's people like Leo who work for years to be sure they can give a sky map in 3 minutes and then we wait up an hour.
Yeah, the current software can do something similar to this with a flip and switch, if you find to do that. It doesn't do everything here, for instance, the ability of several people to control it. The only way to control it right now is editing and configuration module, which in principle a group of people could do, but if you really wanted something more mechanistic, you know, that the particular authority to particular people, that would be probably. And things like a different bar threshold, that's also not built in. But if these things were important, we could do it. But my assumption, I mean, an easy thing to do would be to just have the bar thresholds we have and have the alerts go out. We have, you know, an initial alert, and right now that waits for a human and doesn't have to wait for a human. So on the details, we could add some features, but more or less we could do this.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the best of all.
And Tom, will you put that somewhere so we can find
it? It's on the agenda. I want to see it.
So Albert asked each of us, who were sort of the ring leader organizing the sessions, to just summarize what we heard. And so what I'll do, I put this presentation together quite quickly, so it's just a top level sort of bullet points, takeaway messages from what I heard. But I'd like to hear, do we have time for discussion?
We only have a half hour for
All right, so the session that we started with here was really focused on the near term, mostly on commissioning A-plus and a little bit of Voyager. So we heard five presentations, and I want to go through and just sort of summarize what we learned from those presentations. So it's a bit of a conversion problem. So the first presentation we heard from Daniel Singh, which was a status of where things stand with commissioning, what are the plans for post for pre-O2, what's happening now, what are the plans for post-O2, for pre-O2, basically focusing mostly on laser power, getting 50 watts, some in-vacuum work at Livingston to do some repairs and to add some capabilities, such as these valves and roll-load dampers, things like that. That should get us an increase of about 15% over what we had in O1 in terms of sensitivity. Gets us into where we said we would be in terms of our plan 113 sort of scenarios document. However, there are two caveats. One is that Livingston has problems with its laser, so it will operate only 25 watts, at least in the first half of O2. And perhaps more interesting mystery is what's happening at both frequency and investigations. Are very much ongoing. This is something that got a lot of discussion. You're certainly getting a lot of discussions at my laboratory level, how we can attack this problem. There are still there's been a lot of investigations, but causes are elusive. There are plans for post-O2, so this will get more attention. The plans for post-O2, I was told it's the two big ones, is replace reaction masses. It's well, hopefully going to be this squeeze film damping noise problem that may exist. Because we don't have pressures inside the gap. Also installing squeezing at least one more detectors. So the discussion focused on do we still think we can get to design sensitivity by 2019? And Danielle said that's not unrealistic at this point. We haven't tackled some of these problems. And then there was a nice discussion about what's most important. And I think Salvo said it best. He said low frequency should be the priority. It'll be a win-win, and this is verbatim, so notes here. So we'll get more cycles from neutron star binaries, think how much better PE we can do, and then ask the question, can Virgo be improved too? So I would summarize this as the takeaway message from this talk is low frequency, full speed ahead, trying to make difference.
The upper one in mid and low in the oil. Pretty noisy, but mid-frequency, not
All right, between 30 and 100 hertz,
but not in the bottom paragraph.
Yeah.
That the design discrepancy between program bylaw and
All right, the next talk we heard from Sal was post-detection science, and I'll just walk through. I thought he did a very nice job, actually, of sort of stating what we learned from these binary black hole mergers, and what we didn't learn, and what we want to focus on and get put together quickly. It's just sort of a run through. So we learned that there are heavy stellar mass black holes, heavier than we've seen. We've been able to detect that some of them spin. We were able to test GR, actually, in the strong division as well, sort of outstanding outcomes of our detection. However, this is just a taste of what we were learning. In black holes, for example, we still want to learn their spin perception. We didn't see any evidence of that in the detections. What are the formation channels? Is there some EM counterpart that might still exist and we didn't see any light from that? They may not exist, but certainly keep looking. And then he gave a walkthrough, and I thought it was a really, really thorough walkthrough with a nice summary slide at the end of what we might expect to see in O2 or maybe in O3 or maybe in O4, which is sort of the science activity, or even facility. So CBC, you know, neutron stars are very important. Equation of state may require a new facility to get the signal to noise so that we can actually map out the merger pretty well. Certainly, continuous waves is still a very much an active target. Again, that's something that probably is going to be, you said it right, we still may see something in O1 that we haven't done that analysis yet, but it's more likely to grow through O3. Core collapse supernova, I call that the lucky. Detection, just looking at the rays within the galaxy, and to actually start really hoping to see a stochastic background from, for example, one of the black holes, we really have to really tell all four. So, a lot of the discussion that took place, I didn't summarize it here, was sort of going over all this stuff and what people expressed their attitudes and what they thought was important. Okay, the next talk was by Mike Zucker on A+, who walked through a pretty detailed plan of what A+ will do and what it will give us. So basically, how we'll make it better. So A+ is low frequency dependent squeezing. So that's basically low frequency squeezing, high frequency squeezing, and filter cavities to rotate squeeze angles. They do really pretty small. Quadrature for all of my frequencies, lower thermal noise coatings, that's a key for the next presentation, to balance homodyne readout, and then a bunch of other stuff that needs to be done to be able to do that. For example, there's pretty serious vacuum modifications that we have to use to contemplate long filter cavities. This relies on a breakthrough in coatings, lower thermal noise coatings. If we achieve this, it's a factor of 5 increase in volume of net rate of advanced LIGO. It's operational in 2023, assuming that the funding comes in 2018. That may be difficult given funding constraints, but I'll be optimistic. Preliminary cost is $29 million. There's a challenge there, and Mike pointed it out, that fitting this into the budget envelope that NSF has for these kinds of upgrades. It's going to be something that we're going to have to figure out how to do. What's the way to do that? And I think there is a question that I would really like to ask this group, because I think if we can make a statement in this report, I think it will be very important. Do we, as this group who came to this workshop, do we endorse this A+ plan? Does this look like a reasonable thing to do? Don't worry about budgets or timescales. Those are things that have been taken out. But in terms of what we can achieve, sensitivity, are we not being greedy enough, or are we being too greedy? Is this the Goldilocks solution to the left?
Does it hinge on, it relies on a breakthrough on coating?
Part of it relies on a breakthrough.
Exactly. How much is it worth if it is not? Will the answer be different if you don't get it?
So if you don't get it, I think that factor of 5 goes down to a factor of 2.5 or something like that.
The
at different frequencies. You know, you still win at low frequency and high frequency, but the bucket is where you lose.
And it's to be noted that it could lead to a sequential improvement. You can make the heavy moving, setting up the filter cavity and so forth and so on without changing the masses. The models show that that already gives an incremental improvement. Obviously, that's about food noise, and that can be the upgrade can be finished a few years later with some months of downtime. So it's not a crazy deal.
Okay.
It's not completely stupid.
The coding factors from high frequency, low frequency squeezing.
It's only because you put that line there and it counts immediately.
Yeah, I think the fact that the teaching guide on that means that there's not a meaning that this is not fact.
So I'll modify these slides before they go public. Part of it relies on.
That's right.
All right, just like I said, this was put together in 3 minutes. So.
I should say that I think that the schedule is aggressive, but that's what's needed.
We're not aggressive much.
I guess I wasn't expecting everyone to cheer out. I hear like something that was hitting the horse's crying. I guess we do. I don't really think that there's any other great alternative. It's basically saying what the best we can do on a relatively short time scale. And this is our expression of the best we can do. If you think of the plot that Lisa made for time volume as much as the discussion that generated, it's clear that we've been very quickly if we actually know how to reduce the sensitivity. And there are ways in which we know how to reduce the sensitivity as an expression of that knowledge. I don't think we have a lot of good options.
Meta-knowledge.
We don't actually have the knowledge, but we want to have the knowledge.
Knowledge about knowledge.
What I meant to say is that I think that I endorse the desire to have this on an aggressive time.
That's
a way.
And I would say what I would say is I encourage obviously the run paragraph to consider something very clear, because if we have 2A glass in 2033, we lose the network. I think that's my feeling. We'll have basically two detectors that detect the events, and then the vehicle may not. Enough, unless they do, for, they also consider similar improvements.
I mean, if they're operating design sensitivity, it should still be within a factor 2 or 3 of the lines. So, of course, improvement it would be better, and
yeah,
it would not have an impact.
But those three may be on the margin outside of whether they can have those guys.
I thought Leo said that the
factor of four. But we have the 2 LIGO which are online now, so they don't really get, if we have 2 detectors which are really
maybe different.
So just trying to be slightly held out again. There's 2 things I can think of people might worry about, one we've already talked about, which is ready, especially the coding is we can catch that by the way you describe it. The other one would be a worry that we wouldn't have extracted the appropriate amount of data from the straight A LIGO detector. Thinking back to Lisa's graph of time volume, we could add that to the political decision, obviously. We could add that to the way we described this. If we have already extracted so much time volume search space before we shut down and implement this.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of an implied promise to finish that run, not hurry.
Yeah.
So that seems like a natural thing and an easy thing to do, because all we would be promising to do is delay, which is a very easy promise to make.
I think our learning curve will be logarithmic, will not hit the linear. Like we learn a lot more with 10 black holes than with 1 black hole binary.
So like
120,
I think we want to be as aggressive as we can in pushing this forward. It might point it out that this relies on, not an optimistic assumption, but a realistic assumption of holographic emissioning, that we solve those other low frequency problems too. So, So there's a lot of factors in this. Okay, all right, but I think I heard some of the people that spoke up here. This will get written into a report that everybody will, I think, everybody will get circulated. You'll have a chance. Yeah, you'll have a chance to actually comment on, but I think what I heard is that this plan is the best plan we have and gets us. Okay, good. All right, then we move on to coding thermal noise. And Marty gave us a very nice presentation walking through the physics of the microscopic mechanisms for dissipation in coding thermal noise in coatings, in current coatings. He said, well, we think we know. I thought that was a nice way to put it. So there's some understanding of the loss mechanisms based on this two-level system distribution for different well depths and potentials. Hopping transport. Something is known about the temperature dependence, the loss peak, and we know something about the empirical role of doping because we know when we put pantolones, so we don't really have a great understanding exactly why pantolones. So that. Another point that I thought was very important, and this has been something that has been tried for a long time. I remember back. Oh gosh, in the late 90s, there were groups that were working on, theoretical groups that were working on models coding thermal noise. And we're making some progress, but in terms of really understanding the microscopic model, that hasn't come lately. And basically, there's molecular dynamics simulations going on in Florida that are starting to actually be able to make real predictions, and those real predictions actually have agreement with what we can measure. So having that other element in the mix is very important because it allows you to do a lot of experiments on a computer rather than having to generate multiple codings. Where from here? Ultra-stable, this concept of ideal glasses, I think, is relatively new. It's certainly new, I think, to this community. And it relies on the fact that there is in the energy landscape some perfect place where all the atoms sit in the right place and have their minimum energy, achieving that is almost impossible or impossible. But you can get close to that by basically allowing the atoms when you deposit them on the substrate to sort of pop around in energy space until they find the minimum energies. You do that from heating the substrate. That turns out not to be easy, at least with big optics, but it's something that can be tested on small optics and then you can go out and scale it. There are better characterization techniques that are coming up. And I put as a sort of crystalline coatings too. This is something we've known about for a while. The challenge there is going to be to scale it up. So I don't think this makes any sense for A+, but it might make sense for something longer. But there are real challenges in making uniform coatings that have nanometer or sub-nanometer thickness variations over big, huge test mass apertures. And of course, you must maintain what I call the other coating goodness, low absorption, scatter, uniformity, and things like that. So I thought the presentation here really did a nice job of summarizing where things stand. And from my own point of view, I think this is actually something that really looks, in the last, I think I put it, we've been sort of wandering around in the desert for the last 10 years, other people characterize that as being a little too harsh. I will say, I'll rephrase that as saying, I think these new ideas have not yet been really fully explored, and I think they could be very promising.
I don't know about this last bullet.
You don't want to maintain coding goodness?
Well, we haven't done the calculation, and maybe we're looking for the fastest horse that we're asking for a fast horse that we're not. I don't know. If we gave up some of these things a bit, the fact that 2 or 3 and some of these things would be pleasant to maybe it's worth it to do the thermal noise as well. The scattering is going to be coming for an early budget that will keep it up on, and the absorption will make us use more thermal compensation. But those things are not dominating completely.
So you could do trade studies to see what we're going to talk about.
I think we should loosen up in our quest to improve this very quickly. And then tighten up that more.
You wouldn't. Coding thermal noise is a thing that really needs the attention. I wouldn't dispute that, but I would agree, you know, if we get more of it, it'd make our lives easier in other places. But it's a good point. I think we could, you know, look at trade schools. So. Okay. And then the last thing was Ron is talking about what a Voyager might look like. Again, another nice, very nice presentation. Yeah, the goal here is to basically say, what can you do that's I would say not a large cost, it's not a small cost, but on the order of $100 million, $50 million. We don't know what the cost is at this point, but to build two interferometers, one in Louisiana and one in Hanford, that basically gets you to what the observatory facility was designed to do in terms of basically seismic noise, low frequencies, gas rooms across the high bands. And Ron pointed out that you can come up with these noise curves, but technical noises are always the thing. Fighting, having said that, so this concept, this is not a cryogenic detector, I learned this is a refrigerated detector. kilogram silicon test masses. And you saw a picture of Ron being kind of dwarfed by a pool like that, so get those things. Lasers look achievable. There's a program going on here right now, actually. 1.5 to 2 micron laser development, quantum photodiodes, 80% quantum efficiency, that's not so bad. So the technologies look like they're at hand, but of course there's still a lot of research and development needed, and there are plans, I think, to prototype this at the 40 year over the course of the next couple of years. So that's what I took away from this, and if there's any other discussion, if there are any comments, is there a mailing list that's going to be?
Yeah, we're working on it.
Okay. Is there a microphone?
I just have three quick comments on the previous slide, which is there is a difference between ultra-stable and non-field glass. So they are not the same thing.
Go ahead.
Secondly, Marty had at the end of his talk. Recommendations for research. While I do agree that the culture state of glass is certainly a good issue for the most of that, there are three points that we should preface in here.
So, you want me to put it in the part of the presentation, or we want to make sure we're in the workshop the results?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes, I agree. Your characterization is. Harsh. And let me just put another historical point in here, which is about the idea of ideal glasses, and especially working on that with amorphous silicon, is almost 40 years old at this point. If you go back to the first papers that we've been working on this. Sometimes results in this area are slow to happen. And finding your way through about, you know, trying to understand the structure and what's going to bring on the thermal noise. And lower mechanical loss is difficult work to find a way through this. It's not, it's just a slow process, not just in this field, but in other people that survive this.
I agree. It's a materials physics problem. That's my friends who call it dirt physics. They're actually condensed matter physicists. So they're sort of excited to talk about it. But I think I stand by saying that we've been using dioxide for 10 years now, so we haven't really. The coatings that we're using now are coatings that were really developed 10 years ago. So.
Right, and if you look at Marty's slide, and you look at all of those amorphous glasses that have, all of those glasses that have very similar loss, and you're trying to find.
Yeah, exactly.
You're trying to find why do they all do that, and how can we find some better ones out of that mix?
That's what we're going to do.
Right, it's small.
In a couple of places, amounts of money are mentioned. And I think one has to be careful to distinguish, you know, I mean, so those are very rough numbers in the first 2 to 9 years, level of roughness. I think a useful distinction to make is you know, there's a certain level of, based on metabolism level of funding that we have now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and especially when you talk about something like a bus upgrade, you know, or any of these, and you say, well, it's 30 million, if it's, you know, 100 million. I think what we have to ask the question of is that covering all the costs above basic metabolism? You know, so in other words, for the coating thermal lines, does it need an increase in funding above the current levels of funding? That's significant to be successful. I think it would be very helpful if we could identify those sort of things that need to happen, you know, rather quickly in emphasis.
Yeah, I think there was actually in the last year's Don workshop white paper, basically the statement was made that getting coated thermal noise down is a priority for near-term detectors and long-term too. I think the question of funding is one, you know, that NSF is going to take up. I think there is a desire, and I think there's a proposal that's been noticed, the proposal that's being put together, all right, to try and tap into new money. And maybe Steve's point, I think, is that you know, the reason it's a problem is, you know, hasn't moved is not because it's just hard, it's also because of the resources that have been put onto it too. And I think there's a recognition of that at NSF now, you know, the challenges to get money. As far as the A plus code, you know, costing goes, and Mike will be the first one to tell you, he's not the kind of deal, but he'll be the first one to tell you that those numbers need to be looked at very carefully to make sure that they're scrubbing properly. But they do take it. Might make sure that the basic metabolism is put in there, so that the labor numbers actually go above and beyond what you're going to do for operating reserves or you might do.
On the coding front, maybe it's somewhat of what you were going to mention, but I think it's important that our report reflect the importance of coding progress to the building involved, the fact that it takes a broad approach, an exploratory scientific approach, an engineering approach, and whether you take advantage of any internationalism as possible to get the most out of your expertise also, because it's everybody can do this at the time.
Right.
So I guess we have to be very clear.
Good. I agree. That's a great recommendation.
Either we can design. Matt had shown it in his presentation that now layering is one of the options. I personally think it's maybe more important than most people think. Either
I'll put it on self put it on
or as something that can increase the calibration to a higher temperature.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, Giovanni and I collected what we got as highlights of the second session, which was focused on international network and multi-messenger astronomy in the short, medium term. So here, so we split this in two parts, support the international network, with a presentation from Leo on the status quo 01 in terms of rates and localization. So I'm not going to go through all of the presentation itself. I just pulled out what we got at the key points that kind of drove the rest of the discussion, which is that the fact that the detection rate is set by the second most sensitive detector, but the sky localization is set by the third most sensitive detector. So the localization will improve with the third detector that is at least a quarter as sensitive as Livingstone and Deptford. So that is the starting point. Then we had Lisa's presentation on plausible observing scenarios. Put in there in that corner a little screenshot of the nice graph where she collected plausible plans for the next decades. There is lots of guesswork in terms of when things could run, how that's going to go on. From this, we had this discussion on what are the metrics that are going to establish how to move forwards. We talked about using food money for lottery tickets. We talked about supermarket approach to designing. But I guess the main key point of what we got as an action item for ourselves, so starting, you know, from me personally in terms of DAC and, you know, with the analysis groups and the input we can provide in this, is we will need to come up with a set of metrics that go beyond V times T. So that's what we've been using so far. But what are the other metrics? So how do we factor in what's the science potential moving forward, and how to factor that into the scenarios moving forward? I think there was an agreement that improving the detector, if possible, is the way to go. But we need to keep in mind science as a target. So that's where this new metric should come up. Matt really wanted the function to plot. We have been talking about that over time a lot in the science groups, and it's not so easy to come up with, but we should really have that as an objective in the short term. So keep bugging us to get that done. Then we had a panel discussion on the potential for a coordinated R&D program and the role that Quack would play. So the punchline, and that's what I put up there in the title, is that the quick should interact with the Quack, and that's going to be the new refrain moving forward. In what sense? So we heard that LIGO has a solid plan for the endorsed, right? Virgo has a vision document. The instrumental white paper in the LFC is a good example of how to coordinate the R&D in terms of not replicating efforts too much. So can this be a model for a network program? We ask ourselves, what are the barriers to an international research effort? I think the only concrete kind of quick answer, I think, I heard from Rana, that was people may hide results. But I don't think anything else has really come up on that, apart from the fact that resources are an issue. So achieving comparable sensitivities require investment from the agencies. So coordination of funding require pushing, so we need to be proactive in that. So as a possible short-term action, we should try and foster a more formal structure for coordination. There was some talk about the steering committee. Are we ready for that level of formality? Should we still be at the working group level? It's not clear to me that there was a consensus on this, but you can correct me. Right now, GWAC is operative. It's eager to receive inputs. Again, so that's where we need to have overlap, possibly inputs from us into the week, so that we can quickly track the GWAC. From CAGRA, we heard that the interest is in contributing mostly for third generation moving forwards. And then something that was said earlier in the panel, but ended up at the bottom of this bullet points, is the fact that we cannot really keep talking only with each other. So Gabby suggested this model of maybe we could open the RDC parallel sessions for the first couple of days, or maybe we should reinvent GWAW have any suggestion, to wider fields. So let me like on the comment box. So we want to open it to material scientists, to geophysicists, so other areas beyond just our own community for our energy development. So these were the kind of the highlights that we pulled out of that first part of the session. So I'll stop here for a minute before we go to the next slide. Yes.
Just a detail of interpretation. The one quarter is a great benchmark, but the one quarter was how sensitive it has to be to reduce the sky area by about 50%. So in other words, it's not that, as Harris pointed out in an email, for instance, you know, it's 1/6 as sensitive or something like that, there's still a noticeable improvement in the environmental condition.
Right.
Yeah.
Joe?
Yeah, there really wasn't much time to talk about it when it first came up. We have to be a little more deliberate, I think, before opening on collaboration meetings. Probably worth revisiting the original assumption, which is that when collaborations formed, there were groups that weren't sharing information with each other, particularly in instrument development, because people's funding and career development required the breakthroughs to be credit for them. And so it's a big deal to start sharing everything. And start trusting each other to the point where when a paper was written, there would be paper circulation, people could be added to the paper if they felt that their work influenced the result in a significant way. And as part of people began speaking freely, and a lot of the instrument development led any language resulted from that. We would have to be really careful if we wanted to take that back. So I guess I would claim that we don't have consensus on that point. Is there any?
Yes, I knew. I know about that.
We all know that, but no one said it, so I want to say it.
And I think that is one of the answers. At least the only one I know about what are the barriers of international research network to a broader research network than what we have now to communicate with. Which is already the management, but maybe across collaboration. I think that is one something we have to be careful about, and we could be careful about. I wanted to hear now more about the leaders in that department, and not just about it.
So I am a bit confused. So who can you tie the result in the who can tie the result in the college? It's almost available everywhere. So you mean hiding between idea and publication?
Yes.
Yeah, first a bit of a response to that. I think a thing that we have lost rebounds. Maybe have to rediscover is the virtue we all talk about, but it's not virtue. And that's a hard thing to do in a scientific conference or any other place where you feel that, well, you're taking up the closing you're demonstrating that you don't understand something you're asking for help. And that's a hard thing to do in a completely public environment. I don't know if it can happen in a research community that doesn't have rules about collaboration, that is not closed, pretty open though about thinking about what things are not working because it's an environment like this one. So that would actually be my battle microphone. Notice how this conversation has flowed here and how it doesn't flow at all. I think it has to do with the quality of the space, the character of the space, the fact that there's a relatively limited scope to the mission. We should really try to capture what happened here. Whatever environment it is, whether it's an open environment or a further audience, somehow try to regain this sense of conversation. It's not really to come by, or at least we don't see it so very often. Maybe it's just to come by and just talk about the situation.
Yeah,
focus. It's limited to scope. Small space works, the space is important.
Yeah, one thing that makes me a little bit nervous when I hear R&D and management kind of and global, there are positive words, but somehow when you mix them all together, they become scary. Like one thing that I would like is that we start yielding all the same suspensions for everyone. We have the same squeezers, everyone we have the same lasers, and then if, you know, 5 years in the road or 10 years in the road, one of these solutions would work, then we're kind of stuck. But the variety of the solutions that we have give us confidence that if one doesn't work, it would be maybe another one that works. So I would like to start coordinating at the level that we are all doing kind of the same thing.
That's
not happening.
Not even
within the industry. No, that's it. I agree. You should not.
When you're seeing global, right, one could say, oh, okay, LIGO, let's assume that the statement is, oh, look, you have cycling preservation and suspension that works very well. we should put it in the intro, right? And if I were in the intro, I would say, yeah, we have spent like 30 years, we know how to work with our suspension. Vice versa. And so the point is, it's not like there is only one working solution. There are several working solutions, and we should preserve that, because maybe in 10 years we realize that actually the advanced life cycle regulation is not good anymore.
Much is played on this issue. The part of the reason is, even if you have two working solutions, that require a different amount of time to get ready. We have two detectors that are not ready at the same time. We don't have a network. But at the end of the day, you want a global network for this to work to get this kind of stuff. And you know, that's where a common design actually is really matters.
If we're talking about the work that's happening, you know, not necessarily right in the commissioning, but in the research to develop these systems, I don't think that there's necessarily as much collaboration as there could be. There is, you know, collaboration between the data analysis groups, which we might not do more. But that, you know, when we first started talking about the LIGO video collaboration, there was some discussion about having more collaboration between industry and science groups. That hasn't really happened. Maybe it's time for us to reconsider that idea of opening up some of our instrument science groups to collaboration. Let's start live on here.
Excuse me, could I ask a question now? Basically, I cannot hear you very well, so pardon me if I am asking a question at an inappropriate time. But this is regarding the R&D development and how other prototypes contribute to the plans for the future interferometers after 2020. I'm asking because there were several ideas which came up during the ELBA meeting, and we were planning to check them out, but we'd like to know, like, are they still in the running for A plus, or are they pushed to beyond A plus, or
is what still in the running for A plus?
I see. I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Could you please repeat the question?
Oh, okay. I was saying that we were talking about a global R&D network, which addresses problems for the future interferometers, such as maybe a cryogenic folding mirror or a frequency-dependent squeezing for using arm cavity or quantum non-demolition technique, so to explore any of these problems and inform any proposals that may be forward for the future. We would like to know how much time we have, in a sense. Is the plan for A plus already frozen? Do these problems contribute to that plan, or is it pushed beyond A plus? What's the time scale for exploring this problem?
I don't know if I'm the right person to answer that question, but I think that most of the things that you talked about are too speculative to be in a plus number. So they're important, but there's not a rush in the next 2 years to get them done. Of course, R&D takes time, so sooner is better. But I wanted to, and just like you objected to Dave's characterization of lack of progress and improving, I want to attest to the characterization of lack of coordination or cooperation. We cooperate a lot. We all talk to each other about what we're doing. And really, yeah. For all of these statements, I'd like to have some examples. I think, squeezing, there are a number of groups which are squeezing around the world. We all know each other. We all talk to each other. We talk to each other in meetings. We talk to each other about what we're doing. So yeah, we're visitors. It is actually, there's not a higher level organization that's coordinating everything in the details, but there is cooperation, and I would say to some degree the natural coordination that comes from groups which are trying to produce interesting results.
Especially because there's no coordination.
there's no predefined code structure, but everyone knows what everyone's doing. There's no people out hiding their work. So I think that actually maybe I would say there is coordination matters. And we do share what we do and we work together.
I'm not sure, no, I'm looking for fun. People are probably, what I'm saying is, when we had those beginning of the larger urban collaboration, we actually specifically said our analysis groups are going to be one. We didn't do that with instrument science group. So it's not like when we hold the LSE holds its office working group as its telecom, it's the LSE's office working group.
This looks like a spokesperson.
I'm not saying we have the opportunity, if we can have more collaboration.
Can you make a concrete example of the problem that you want to solve?
Yes, when CAGR people want to participate in the expansion course, we have to go through the senior folks who just have them in the mailing list of the expansion group and to attend the table because they are not NDC members. Even with Virgo, Virgo doesn't have the same structure. Working groups at the NSC that every week we have working groups, so the communication happens only in conferences and there's a lot of tension, not the IPNC meeting because we don't have that group of people, but then when we start to see because these are different groups, it's just logistics, it's simply that.
It doesn't sound like an instrument problem.
No.
Okay, now we're talking about instrument part.
That was very useful.
I'll say that several years ago there was a rule change with the LLC so that folks from Virgo could participate, for instance, in just a VG meeting without having to have special votes, that kind of things.
And we've had people who heard of that called themselves, not very many, not as much as I would say. The programmatic barrier there has been limited. And so far as I care, that's true for the people that have been called that too. Personally, the biggest issue I see with Beergo, speaking about the monthly call problems, means that they're, you know, 6 or 7 o'clock on Friday night, they're on call all week, which sometimes they can be better than this with you. And if they're in Japan, it's like, that's completely focused, right? And I know the control systems that we has recently adopted two plans, and there are two calls a month to try to make it easier for people from Chicago and Australia to get in on the monthly calls, as well as people from Europe. But I mean, that's, you know, I think it's a religious and social part. You know, there's some things that people are trying to do with this logistics. So, I think, you know, in a good relationship, there's a lot of time that matters in the world. I think that's a big problem that we've got to involve us in. Full respect, it's not the one that we're asking for. And, you know, there are good motivations, and that talks about people doing stuff, no, there's good motivation for people to try to fly with it. There's more understanding, okay, it's working this time. So, I mean, I think it's not nearly as dire as some people would suggest.
So I think one of the things that we think about it as focusing on a different thing. There's collaborating on the stuff we work on just now, which on who is kind of liable, it's kind of about updates to what I can if it's Canada, it's kind of about Canada. So I think a different talking about coordination of a different structure is thinking about people having different footing and a different focus. So for instance, the EG design study is a prime example of bringing together people in many different countries in Europe to work together towards a specific different goal. So it's not just a question of people from, you know, one collaboration joining another collaboration to tell them to talk to one another, having a different focus.
I think that's maybe going back to the global coordination thing. I mean, there are indeed, there are only two letters there. And certainly, when you are, we don't want to be just single minded because the idea might not pan out. But we actually have plenty of examples in the UGL where we start pick the labels. There were three groups of these R that made it down to like there's only one.
It would have been better probably have 4 labels.
Yeah, but it also costs a lot of money at that point, you know? So I think there's a natural way to distinguish this. If it, you know, if it's cheap idea somebody can do with the student aside, I would be make big coordination. The other hand, because the big facility like 40 meters, I mean, it makes a lot more sense to coordinate and ensure the facility actually gets used.
I find the best coordination happens when you just have long group of people, up to 6 months, or really kind of very good, because the telecom is almost sort of minimal.
I have a comment that resembles Danielle's in some way. Comes from my experience with advanced lighting, and also when I talk to Giovanni or the advanced Virgo, I think an enormous amount of work is duplicated at the engineering level, and not necessarily the final production engineering level, but just, you know, so often we find that people make designs which are similar or at least have the same objective and could be unified across the research domain. It'd be wonderful if we had a more dynamic way for just doing that kind of
step beyond the bar, a step where you, you know, you say, okay, let's make 25 Faraday isolators that work damn well, that got, you know, they got apertures for all of these applications. It's not really interesting to the engineering person to do a Faraday isolator. And if you can unify on that kind of thing, I think you would have some economies of scale when you look at research. It would also get people talking to more detail. Okay, yeah, there's a point of diminishing returns to that kind of thing, but I think it would really help out to have something that goes beyond just our discussion and more into the deep sorts of developments.
I think after we can let you move on because I already blew my budget inside.
So I think that we need to consider that the problems are coming up. Everything's increasing. The acidities that water rise are increasing. So which I think it's the right thing to decide that if also the kind of collaboration, it's a personal kind of collaboration should increase, should evolve with time, or is good what we have now. Both of them are dignity with the decision. So R&D is true that when you start with R&D, it's better to have as much as possible options, because when you start, you don't know where you go. And in this case, they call the readiness level. So when you are at the beginning, and your TRL work is the beginning. It's okay to have many R&D. But when the R&D progress and some of the options start to be maybe more promising than the other, in this case enters the coordination. In this case, if the cost start to increase, we are talking about bigger objects. If the costs are increasing, the coordination can be used. I have in mind, I think maybe I'm wrong, but which is the diameter of the new diameter? Is it 34 meters? 34. 34? The Virgo 1 at 35. That caused to LMA to generate the different plants and with additional cost without particular reason. That is true. Okay? It's an example of lack of coordination. And it's not a question of. Having his own idea or clever idea is 34 versus 35 and generated cost. So I think that the coordination, when the level of readiness is high, almost to avoid that kind of mistakes.
Right, so on this note, I think I should move to the second part of it. Maybe this will go faster, I think it was less controversial. So this has to do with coordination with our EM partner. So we had a talk from Peter who reviewed what worked and did not work. It took me a while to record that. In O1, it's another nice acronym. So just in three bullet points here, the partnership with EM actually was a successful experience in O1. It showed that there was common interest in Buddhist science, so the motivation was there. There were some aspects that worked less well than expected, and so I you know, his slide has very well structured layouts. The one thing that I wanted to highlight is that the forum did not work as well as was hoped for. So we had this idea of having the joint forum, common discussion, and that did not happen as well. Also, there was no coordination of the follow-ups, and on our side, on the LSC side, there was some confusion on SkyMaps and coordination. So those were things that, those were what I took back. There were other aspects that were more technical that I don't think it's worth spending time on now. I see Lee already disagreed with me. So then we had a panel with input from some of our partners, which is still here. I think there was pretty uniform agreement. Actually, I don't think there was any controversy on the fact that it's important to have rapid communication of as much information available as possible. So Antonio suggested have a first trigger with a preliminary flag. We talked about 30 minutes or less, so just also some possible implementation from Pablo. We need on our end to also revise the mechanism for false alarm thresholds, maybe be less conservative and allow for correction in the follow-up, even call back an alert if necessary. So I think Fred made the point that as we were discussing all of this, we didn't take into account that not all trigger generators are equal, so we need to allow ourselves some flexibility. So that's something that we may wanna revise. Importance of giving sky map and significance together with the trigger. And there was a recommendation from Neil to not hold back on binary star events. And there is interest in VPH events. So as long as we let the astronomers know what our best guess for the idea is, they can work on that. So maybe now that we have done our post detection, we can be a little bit less conservative or worried about false advertisements or pop-ups. Something else that's interesting that came out, that we'd be interested in MOUs for focus science target, focus papers, deeper collaboration, even in the era of public triggers. So there is going to be all sets of astronomers who are going to just be interested in following up on the load of events. But for instance, as Jim was saying, that we could have still focus sorted targets, sorted papers, and continue this level of external level use of time to pass. And then, so Albert also mentioned that there's something else that could be considered as we review how the agreements should be modified. There has been interest from the NRAO director to be part of our discussions in helping them understand or decide on allocation for observer time. So is that something that we should offer or not? So that's also something that we should consider as we think about how to modify the model for the partnership. So those, again, were the main points that took out. I'll remove correct in, I don't know what's that out of this one here. I guess Leo is on first. Yes.
I think that the lack of coordination is actually something that went well, should be in the positive side of that. And the reason is that because there are actually fairly few facilities that have comparable, comparable sensitivities in the same band on the same side of the Earth, it actually naturally segments itself. And the thing that, but by not, explicitly, providing that coordination ourselves, the sort of natural collaboration that happens in GRB follow-up, where there's a lot of interplay between facilities that have long working relationships with each other, happens for gravitational wave follow-up as well.
On the last point with the NRAO director, I'm not sure exactly what that means, so maybe you can amplify, but I don't know what it means to be privy to the discussions with the liaison.
I didn't go into more detail, but I guess I can. He said his user community has a lot of really sharp-elbowed people who make it hard for him to scale the time because they're pushing each other around to get the right observations. And he would like to have some sense of what it makes sense from a strategic perspective when we request. And you get to request from time that are overlapping.
Okay, but of course we don't attempt to broker that at all.
I didn't say that, but at least he knows it's coming as opposed to just,
and he may actually decide. Sometimes he gets requests from people that don't have relationships, small relationships with us, so that is an insight.
Okay, so if we could notify him of
who he would be an observer, he's not gonna
I'm just trying to figure out what the information. So if we share with him the list of the observers who are partners, basically, which is not otherwise openly available to the public. And also give Yeah, anybody in a similar situation, the opportunity to enroll and get the same email messages and alerts that everybody else gets, then it sounds like that would come over.
Well, look, the easiest thing at this point is we shared what he shared with us. Give him a call and tell who you are and tell him how can you know about this and find out what his thoughts are.
Okay. I think this is one of the reasons why I went to Ben to get a different group to find the Ben. So they can go and do many other groups. But then I know this is not the best and that's the
that kind of content. I think part of the sensitivity is we happen to have a PAC meeting shortly before the announcement, and we actually shared with the PAC what was going to be presented at the press conference. And he mentioned casually during a coffee break that the follow-up to G150914, which he didn't know about the Z, for example, and it was a big broad swath of the sky. He estimated it cost him $250,000 of operations. And he said, you know, when you're starting to deal with big bucks like that from his perspective, there should be some insight provided to the people who run the observatory. And, you know, think about it. If LIGO were not an all-the-time, all-sky observing device where you actually had to arrange it somehow. I think Dave and I and NSF would like to know before people go rearrange our instrumentation. So I think it's a reasonable request coming from someone who runs NRAO.
Yeah, I'm not saying it isn't.
Okay.
I'm trying to figure out how we can help.
Talk to Tony. Talk to Tony. He's a big fan, so. In fact, if you remember, he actually submitted an MOU, and we politely told them that directors need not apply for MOUs. Remember?
That's why he's struggling.
Yeah.
Good point.
So, okay. Anyway, I only have two slides. I'm sorry.
Comment.
Sure.
With more, we can add a distance to the distance by the
distance.
Oh, okay.
But that is us. That tells us how long
Exposed from the technology. Oh, distance to the distance. Yes.
I think we already talked about making this a four-dimensional map. It was distance was included and it happened before and then angle.
I'll agree.
Supposedly we'll have four-dimensional maps.
Well, there's some technical development that we need to do there. There's some technical development that we need to be able to do before we can make that happen because it's actually fairly non-trivial to extract a smooth density estimate from our posterior sample in the source out there. I mean, we do have, you know, enough samples, but we don't have every time we want to get an extra dimension out.
So we'll start with three minutes.
Yes,
four dimensions seems to be.
All right. So I'm going to just wrap up. We pretty much talked this subject to death this morning, so I just have two slides. The first, I classify these as takeaway points that you will see in the report when we get the draft out that we will go to the attendees. The first point that we heard in Ray's talk was that we really do want to work on a charter for an NRC study. And that's a U.S. Focused effort, obviously. So come up with a small group with a draft in charge for the charter, and then I can imagine we would include it as an appendix to the report so that the attendees can see what kind of charter we're talking about. It was also made clear in various presentations that we want to mature or need to mature the U.S. concept into design schedules and costs. And there seemed to be a consensus that we want to try to coordinate just with PE partners in the sense of making sure that whatever they do in their updates and iterations for the ET study going forward has some acknowledgement that there's an effort in the United States that is coming along at the same time. We also have to work on developing further the science case for the next generation instruments. What are the big questions they will address? The science that will drive the network design. And this is an effort that I think is properly also something which should be undertaken at on a larger scale than just the US partners. Then the last point was, we want to promote a strong interaction between WIC and WAC.
What's the
and and interaction and communication is crucial to promoting a global effort. Common components where it makes sense, coherent R&D to optimize resources where that makes sense. And Jim Brown gave us a nice insight into how what we have going forward may in some way parallel the HEP's organizational structure between the global community and the funding agencies. And we also learned that global interest in future facilities is growing rapidly. We have an honored guest here from Tsinghua University, two guests from Tsinghua University. And it was mentioned in Australia. I think it was you, Sheila, that said that there may be some heat moving up in Australia. I don't know. Okay. And we've also been told or heard that other countries are also interested in looking at next generation technologies here. So the question is, when it might be appropriate to invite some of these to the BRIC table to expand the discussion if they're really potential players going forward. So those are the takeaway points that I had in this extended conversation that we had this morning. Yes,
please. I don't need the mic. Can we make this an actual climate guide? Dollars and euros be antiparticles.
That adds up to zero, though. It's not a zero sum game. It's not a zero sum game.
I think you are missing the remainder.
India.
Okay.
India is also interested in your volunteer.
Yeah. You're right. Absolutely. Thank you. That was not intentional.
Al, can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
What might be a vision then? What might be the way to put this group that's trying to get this charter for the NRC community together? How are you imagining we should do that?
Well, I sent you an email which you haven't read yet.
Again,
I sent you an email which you haven't yet seen.
I have, no, I can't get
right. But I think what we want to do is take a look at a proper balance between people who've been around the block, who know what is involved in these things, and people who are actually going to be pushing the field forward at the time that it's appropriate.
Well, should I think do that better? Have you guys got to do that?
We can talk about it offline. Sounds like you're a volunteer to be involved, though. Thank you.
Distract me with
so. I guess without further ado, thank you everybody, and I guess we can consider this a successful adjournment of a two-day workshop. Thank you.
I want to say a few words. First of all, to thank the local organizer and the students helping with the mic. Thank you. This has been a great workshop. And I also want to especially thank the organizing committee that includes the three chairs of the session that, even though we were very busy with many other things and I only had with a very minimal charge to organize everything, they did a great job and they are going to leave the writing of the report of the workshop, which is just as important as the conversations we've had here, so we don't forget what we don't say. So thank you, Albert, Dave, and Laura. And now we can consider this a joke.